From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Today, after President Obama's State of the Union address, we get the reaction from Michigan's members of Congress.
I don't think this president has done nearly enough to reach out to Congress on a consistent basis.
Plus, the It's Just Politics team fills us in on a busy night in Lansing.
State of the State and State of the Union leads to the state of narcolepsy.
And we ask, was Beethoven's music influenced by a heart problem?
Heavy of heart can mean a lot of things. It can mean you're sad. But it can also mean that you're literally feeling a heaviness upon your heart. Nowadays, we would call that angina.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty.
How do we create opportunities for those people that are not in the mainstream of this river of opportunity is the question.
Governor Snyder there delivering last night's State of the State address, and we'll hear more about that speech later this hour. But of course, for political junkies, Tuesday night was a double feature, with President Obama also delivering his State of the Union address. Let's get some reaction from Michigan's members of Congress. Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee is on the line from Washington. And Congressman, first off, before we jump into your thoughts on the speech itself, you had a moment where you spoke with the president as he was walking down the aisle, you know, greeting lawmakers as presidents do, making his way to the lectern to deliver the speech. And I understand you got a chance to talk to him about Amir Hikmati, the former Marine who is being held in Iran.
Right. You know, I took advantage of that moment to, again, remind the president of Amir's condition. He continues to be held in an Iranian prison now 3.5 years. The president's obviously very aware of Amir's situation, but I felt like it was an opportunity to me to continue to elevate Amir's case, talk directly to the president about him.
So what's the administration's response been so far?
Well, they've been very helpful, very responsive. Between the president, Secretary Kerry, and others, I'm very confident that Amir's case continues to be a priority. But it's important that as his representative in Congress that I continue to push his case.
Let's talk about the speech now. Much has been made about the president's somewhat defiant tone, telling Republicans again last night that he'll not be afraid to veto legislation he doesn't like. We've also seen him over the past couple of weeks touting some initiatives. Many of them are getting a lot of pushback from the GOP, and pundits in Washington are saying these are dead on arrival. Are there parts of the speech where agreement can be found?
Well, there should be. For example, I think around the subject of transportation and infrastructure, those issues typically have not been partisan issues. So I don't see any reason where, despite big differences on some of the other questions that the president raised, that we shouldn't be able to make progress on a surface transportation bill that invests in our long-term infrastructure. You know, there are not Democratic or Republican roads or bridges, so we ought to be able to get together on that question.
What about some of the other things he talked about, like paid leave and minimum wage?
Well, obviously those are much more divisive in some ways. It is an issue, though, I think, that we ought to be able to come together on. I don't see any reason when it comes to minimum wage that we couldn't recognize that when America's consumers have more purchasing power, that everybody benefits. Not just the consumer, not just the American citizen, but American businesses benefit. Now, Henry Ford understood that over 100 years ago when he doubled the wages of workers on the auto factory line. So if it's true then, it can be true again.
Your district, including Flint, has been hit so hard economically. What did you hear in the president's address last night that felt like he was maybe talking about the people that you represent?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, his emphasis on tax fairness, you know, the folks that I talk to, you know, they deal with all the struggles that every American does. But when you think about middle income earners and what he would offer with a significant tax break for those middle income earners, I think it would make a difference for the people in Flint, Saginaw, Bay City who get up and go to work every day. I will say that I have some concerns over some of the issues that he raised. He brought up trade policy.
Right. I wanted to ask you about the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah, I mean, this is a subject that I have to part company with the president on. I think our communities, the ones I represent, have seen, you know, too much the results of these trade agreements that are said to increase exports and increase jobs, but have not had that effect. So I'm very concerned that the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's being negotiated will not include the kinds of provisions required to protect American jobs, and particularly concerned that it will not include strong protections against currency manipulation, which is one of the ways that other nations have been able to undermine American exports. So I'm not in line with the president on that particular subject.
Finally, I want to talk about the last several minutes of his speech. He basically said, hey, we can work together, come on, after having just told the Republicans in the chambers that, hey, you said none of my stuff would work. Look at what we've done. We've done made so much progress. Now, after I've made the point that you're wrong and I'm right, now let's work together. Did you think he approached that correctly?
Well, you know, obviously he took the moment to do a bit of a victory lap. And I think his comment about having won the last couple of elections and using his veto pen, that might have been saved for another venue. I think the president's right that we need to set aside these old ways. But I think that has to come from everybody, not just Congress. It has to come from the president. And I will acknowledge, even as a Democrat who supports him, I don't think this president has done nearly enough to reach out to Congress on a consistent basis. So that's going to be a challenge that I hope he's willing to rise to.
That's Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee of Flint. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Also in the House chamber last night was freshman member of Congress Mike Bishop, a Republican from Rochester, Michigan. Welcome, first of all. And as a former state legislator, you've probably seen a number of State of the State addresses. But what was the experience of a State of the Union address like for you?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. This has been nothing but just a thrill to be a member of Congress and to be able to sit in that chamber last night and listen to the president in his State of the Union address. Sitting in there as I first walked in, it was something that I've always wanted to do, and it was one of those check-the-box moments.
What, if anything, did you hear in the speech that made you think, now that might be something I can get behind?
There were a number of things that I could get behind, and I try to gravitate towards those items that we can all work together on. First and foremost was the identity theft cyber security issue that the president raised, and the need to address those issues in a bipartisan way. I would agree with him. This is not a Republican or a Democrat thing. It's very much an American thing. I also would agree with the president with regard to comprehensive immigration reform. I think it's about time that Congress did something to come together and not deal with this in a piecemeal fashion, but to address it in a way that creates clear public policy so that everyone understands.
The president also talked a lot about middle-class economics, including things like paid sick leave, a child care tax cut, paying women the same as men for doing the same work, increasing the minimum wage. How do you think those ideas will play back home in Michigan's 8th congressional district?
Well, the problem with the proposals is that, you have to pay for them at some point in time. And we heard about $300 billion in new programs last night, and the idea that we would increase the size of government right now and increase spending and do that at the expense of taxpayers because it calls for tax increases, to me, is the wrong way to go. I think that the president has gone down a path that his own members won't support, which disappoints me because I was hoping that this president would come out yesterday and really put on the table measures that we could all talk about, we could all work together on, and instead you had four veto threats, a lot of this is what I'll do and this is what I won't do, kind of me in a speech which disappointed me, and I almost think that the president's tone was taunting last night, and it did not come across very well.
The president also talked about the importance of trade. He wants a fast-track authority for trade agreements such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which you got a standing ovation from the Republican side of the aisle. I take it that you might be in favor of that as well?
Well, I think that we'd all like to see some fairness in the trade practices. The United States has been kind of taking the brunt of a lot of unfair trade practices around the world, and it's really hurt our economy, it's hurt the American worker, and it's something that we like to see the president engage in and be a real leader on.
You know, but when I was listening to that, it made me think about our biggest trading partner, Canada. Work is going ahead on that new international trade crossing in Detroit. Canada is paying for that bridge. All the U.S. has to do is build its own customs plaza, but so far, no money's been set aside by the Department of Transportation for that or in the presidential budget. Now, I want to make a point clear. You've received campaign donations from the owners and managers of the Ambassador Bridge. They don't want that new international trade crossing at all. What's your position on funding the customs plaza?
Well, the campaign contributions, regardless of what some might think, has nothing to do with my position on that. Long before I ever received a campaign contribution, I opposed the new international trade crossing only because it wasn't necessary and we couldn't afford it. Michigan was in the very lowest of lows financially. We were in a death spiral financially, and we were looking to build a new bridge at a time we couldn't afford it, and that's why I opposed it, and to me that's just common sense.
Well, at this point, right, it's now, not going to cost Michigan any money. It will cost the U.S. government money for the Customs Plaza.
Well, it'll therefore cost Michigan money. Michigan still has to pay back that debt to Canada through tolls. But I would agree with you, it's less expensive now than it was when first proposed when I was in the legislature. Canada didn't have that offer on the table at the time. But I will tell you that when it comes to that new customs plaza, it also requires the Gateway Project, which is about another $400 million out of taxpayer funds. It's not free, and it's expensive.
That's Congressman Mike Bishop talking about his first State of the Union address as a member of Congress. I'm sure you'll see many more in the future. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. As we heard last night in Governor Snyder's State of the State address, one of the most challenging issues facing the new state legislature is school funding. The Citizens Research Council has just released a new report looking at the problems of shrinking public school enrollment and how that makes it tough for districts to manage their finances and ways Lansing could support struggling school districts. Craig Thiel is Senior Research Associate with the Citizens Research Council. He spoke with Cynthia about that report.
This report hit me right between the eyes with one line. The last time public school enrollment was at this level was in the late 1950s. That's a pretty stunning picture of how enrollment is shrinking. Can you put that into numbers for us?
Back in 2003, we had about 1.7 million students enrolled in public schools, and that's both traditional public schools as well as charters. And over the last 10 years, statewide enrollment has declined to 1.5 million today.
Okay. What are we seeing as the causes? I'm sure it's easy to say the Great Recession is kind of the evil that plagued so much of Michigan in that time, but can you take us more deeply into the causes?
Birth rates, primarily. People are having fewer kids. So that's putting pressure on the number of public school students that are enrolling. And then add to that the economic challenges of the last decade as mm-hmm. people pursued economic opportunity in other states. They moved their family and took their school-age children with them.
That makes sense. Big employer in town shuts the plant. People have to leave to follow where the jobs are. So we're looking at demographic pressures and economic pressures.
That's correct.
And then to kind of put the cherry on top of the not-so-happy sundae for schools is the fact that the public charter schools opened and started, you know, becoming more attractive to more families.
Right. For individual districts, they're impacted by those two broader trends, demographic and economic. But the competition for students in Michigan has grown immensely. We've seen an explosion in the number of service providers in the education market in the state. And this is primarily the result of adding more charter schools and other education providers, online cyber schools as well. If you can think of public education enrollment as a pie, the pie is shrinking and the pie is being sliced into more pieces. So it only stands to reason that certain slices are being pared down.
Craig, how does the way Michigan funds public schools right now fit into this picture?
We are heavily reliant on the foundation grant, which is a per-pupil amount that's set by Lansing every year. Those dollars are used to fund the vast majority of school operating costs. The amount of foundation dollars that a district receives are directly tied to the enrollment. As a student leaves, he takes with him or her that roughly $7,000 grant. And, of course, the economics of school finance are such that when that student leaves, the costs associated with that student don't all leave with him immediately. there's some costs that are still tied up in employing the teacher that was previously responsible for educating that student. What happens is the money in a declining enrollment environment leaves with the student, but some of the costs remain with the district for a period of time.
So here's this district kind of paddling furiously to keep its head above the water.
Exactly, and it takes some time to right-size these budgets. The revenue impact from declining enrollment is immediate. Districts have to recognize these reduced resource levels immediately in next year's budget, and they're expected, because they're required to have balanced budget, to reduce spending. And the logical place to reduce spending is in their labor, instructional teaching force. But the reality is the costs associated with that student don't allow a teacher to necessarily be eliminated when there's 24, 25 other students that still need that teaching position to be in place.
So is there a fix? What does the Citizens Research Council of Michigan feel could help struggling districts that are, you know, crunched by these fixed costs and declining enrollment?
Some of them aren't novel. Some of them are just things that the state used to do. There used to be some money set aside for declining enrollment districts. Smaller districts that had a hard time adjusting budgets in the short term were eligible to receive one-time resources to help manage their finances through this declining enrollment period. Because of the budget challenges of the last decade, those grants were done away with. The state also used to count students based on a portion of their previous year enrollment. So not just the current year enrollment, but the previous year. So if you were a declining enrollment district and you lost students one year over the next, you got a little extra bump from having some students last year that you don't have this year. And that helped moderate the fiscal effects.
I can imagine this blended student count formula would kind of give you a cushion to kind of soften that blow, at least for a while, help you maybe prepare.
And it doesn't completely absolve the district from having to recognize fewer students. It's just a transition. It allows the gradual reduction in spending rather than an abrupt disruption or reduction.
And then finally,
our recommendation was to look at the structure of the foundation grant. It's designed to represent the cost of educating a student, and some of those costs are fixed, and some of those costs are variable. The grant right now treats all of the costs associated with the student as variable. In other words, when a student leaves, it's estimated that all of the costs with that student also leave. Well, in reality, some of those costs remain with the districts. If there were some study put into the portion of the grant that represents the fixed costs of educating a student and the variable costs, then make the finance system work such that some of those fixed costs remain with the district for some period of time.
So the report from the CRC basically calls on policymakers to consider some of these ideas that you've just spelled out. Is there any sense that there is the interest or the will to do that?
I'd like to point out that Proposal A, the school finance system that we have in place today, is over 20 years old. The last school finance system that preceded Proposal A lasted about 20 years. There's been considerable interest in school finance reform by the State Board of Education. The governor and the legislature have all weighed in and have recommended different reforms. Based on that, it suggests that school finance reform is a topic that's primed for this new legislature to take on. We're suggesting that this phenomenon of declining enrollment be one of the considerations when they look at reforms for how we fund schools.
And what price do Michigan's schools and thus students pay if things aren't changed in business as usual?
Most of the districts dealing with declining enrollment have successfully managed through this period. It hasn't been without pain or reductions in services and programming at the district level. So it should be said that most of the districts are dealing with it. Where it really becomes a problem is when ongoing declining enrollment and districts can't get in front of it. And there needs to be some opportunity where they can just kind of stabilize the finances for a period where they can get a plan in place. Worst case scenario, declining enrollment can lead to severe fiscal stress for school districts, and the state has had to step in on a number of districts to deal with the financial problems of the Buena Vistas and the Inksters and the Muskegon Heights of the state.
Craig Thiel, Senior Research Associate with the Citizens Research Council, out with a new report, Managing School District Finances in an Era of Declining Enrollment. Good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Cynthia.
¶¶
It's been more than 200 years since Ludwig van Beethoven wrote his masterful music, despite being deaf. But could his music actually have been influenced by heart trouble? A team of researchers from the University of Michigan and the University of Washington is offering a really intriguing theory. They believe that as Beethoven composed some of the most famous masterpieces, that his music truly was from his heart, influenced by his cardiac arrhythmia. Dr. Joel Howell is a professor of internal medicine at the University of Michigan School of Medicine. He's also a medical historian and a member of the team that developed this theory. Dr. Howell sat down with Cynthia to talk about his findings.
What led you to this? What uncorked this idea in the first place for you and your fellow researchers?
Well, it basically just came about as the three of us were talking about the music of Beethoven, and we're all three amateur musicians. We all play the piano, we all listen to this sort of music, and we started thinking about ways in which our mutual areas of expertise might give us some more insights into what we were hearing.
Well, there is a really interesting array of backgrounds on this team. You're the medical historian, and who else was involved?
That's right. The lead author is Zach Goldberger, who actually was here with us in Ann Arbor when we started the study. He is a cardiologist, so he specializes in diseases of the heart. The third author is Stephen Whiting, who is a musicologist. He studies classical music, and his specialty is Beethoven. So it was, if you will, a dream team of three people, all of whom came together to ask some fairly provocative and, quite frankly, inferential questions.
So what made you think, wow, could that be arrhythmia? I guess I'm wondering, is there historic proof that Beethoven suffered from cardiac troubles?
Well, that's an excellent question. And when you use words like proof, the answer is almost always no. There is no proof. The problem with any proof is that the tools and instruments that we would use today to diagnose heart disease simply did not exist in Beethoven's time. Furthermore, the very disease categories that we think of today also didn't exist. There have been a long, long list of diseases that Beethoven has been speculated as suffering from. And many of those diseases would lead, as we now understand it, to abnormal heart rhythms. And that's what we are assuming, is that because he had some of these other diseases, it's highly likely that his heart was part of the problem as well.
So take us into, as you and your fellow researchers dug into Beethoven's music, what kind of clues were you looking for?
Well, one of the clues we were looking for is simply the rhythm of the music, the sound of the music. We know for sure that Beethoven was deaf. He started to become deaf, and then eventually at the end of his life, he was profoundly, completely, totally deaf.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was deaf, we think it's highly likely that he would be more aware of his own heartbeat. If you yourself, for example, want to sit in a very, or lie down even better, in a very quiet place where there are no other sounds around, you can sometimes hear the beating of your heart. So imagine if you lived your entire life, or a significant portion of your life, having no hearing of the outside world, you might be more likely to be aware of your heartbeat. We also were fortunate, and this is where the dual expertise of the people in the team comes in looking at some different ways of translating and thinking about the music that we talk about in the piece. So, for example, there's one section where he talks about himself as being a piece of music as being heavy of heart. Now, heavy of heart can mean a lot of things. It can mean you're sad. It can mean you're heart sick because of some loss. But it can also mean that you're literally feeling a heaviness upon your heart. Nowadays, we would call that angina. In Beethoven's day, we didn't have that term.
Well, let's take a listen. This is the final movement of the cavatina in Beethoven's string quartet in B-flat major, opus 130. This piece was completed in 1825.
Thank you.
section and some of the other sections make us think that perhaps he was experiencing some kind of shortness of breath, that that he wasn't able to breathe because his heart was malfunctioning. Now, slipping into 21st century terminology in terms that would have been completely alien to Beethoven or the physicians of his day, the way we would now describe it is that if your heart is not beating effectively, it's not pumping blood effectively, and you are not getting enough blood going to the lungs, that you start to feel short of breath and you start to breathe faster because you're being less effective in your breathing. Maybe that's what was happening here. Maybe that's reflected in the cavatina in Opus 130, the string quartet.
It's kind of unbalanced rhythm.
Yep.
What kind of response have you gotten from the music world or from the medical world since this essay was published in Perspectives in Biology and Medicine?
Oh, we've had a huge response, and it's been very, very interesting. One of the responses that we got is that this is all totally speculative. And our answer to that is, you're absolutely right. It's totally speculative. We can never prove that this is right. Nobody can ever prove it. But we simply think that it's a logical observation. The medical community and the music community actually have a lot in common. There's tremendous interest in music among physicians. A lot of physicians, well, Zach Goldberger and myself, like to think of ourselves as amateur piano players. There are musicians here on campus who play music. The Life Sciences Orchestra is made up of musicians from the medical center. And we have a whole medical arts program in which we are trying to use the arts to help physicians learn how to be better doctors. So it's not just a matter of being better cocktail party conversationalists or more well-rounded, but we really think that music and the arts can help teach you how to be better at practicing medicine.
And as you worked on this study and listened to Beethoven's music and kind of drew these conclusions, what kind of insights do you think you now have about who this man was and how he created?
I think that the more that anyone learns about Beethoven, the more time you spend with Beethoven, the more you understand his music, the more you realize the incredible genius that he represents. And there's a reason that he is canonized the way he is. The more you learn about his music, the more you realize that every note, every phrase, every symbol, everything about it just reflects genius. And he changed so much over the course of his life. He didn't just write the same kind of music over and over again. He changed dramatically from his early works to his later works. Looking at the rhythms and trying to figure out where they came from, in no sense is to imply that he was simply formulaically taking what he felt in his body and writing it down in music. I think he was using that as one source of inspiration, amongst many sources of inspiration that he used to write his music.
Very, very interesting essay from researchers from the University of Michigan and the University of Washington, offering up this theory that as Beethoven composed some of his most famous masterpieces, the music was influenced by his cardiac arrhythmia. And we have been talking with Dr. Joel Howell from the University of Michigan School of Medicine, where he's a professor of internal medicine, and also he's with the School of History and the School of Public Health. Thank you so much for talking with us, Dr. Howell.
Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham sitting in for Cynthia Canty. So last night, not only did we hear from President Obama and the State of the Union address, but we also heard from Governor Rick Snyder and the State of the State address. There at the Capitol were Rick Pluta of the Michigan Public Radio Network and Zoe Clark of Michigan Radio and our own resident political junkie. So you guys got to listen to the speech. I think the number one thing that was on the governor's mind last night, in my impression, was talking about rotten roads and bridges, talking about 1 in 9 bridges were structurally deficient. And here's what he wants voters to do in May.
Vote yes, so we can get rid of those crumbling bridges and crumbling roads. Vote yes, so we can have stronger schools and local government. Vote yes, so we can have tax relief for lower income people.
Now, as that clip inferred, there are a lot of pieces to this ballot initiative that's going to be coming up. Are the voters going to get it? And how much does this confusing, multifaceted part of this ballot measure
First, if anything, let's just say if you were playing, you know, the governor's speech bingo or any type of drinking game.
As some people were last night.
And vote yes, man, you could not even make it halfway through that. through that speech.
Well, you would have been, although if you had chosen shout out, you actually would have been probably further along by the end of the speech.
Or River of Opportunity.
Right.
Shout out was still number one.
Well, let's talk about this this thing
that
the voters are going to be looking at.
Lester,
I want to talk about what the voters are going to be looking at in May and this idea of fixing the roads, but also dealing with this massive measure that the voters are going to be looking at.
And this was the speech was like a little under 50 minutes. And he spent the first he spent the first 20 minutes, as governors do, but talking about last year, what was done, but also what wasn't done. And one of the things that wasn't done is lawmakers figuring out a way to pay for the more than $1 billion a year that the governor and a lot of folks in the state pretty much all agree on is needed. What they can't agree on is how to pay for it.
Rick, how many state of the state speeches has the governor proposed funding for roads?
I think this would be the second or third where he has.
I think it's at least the third.
For all of them?
Yes. Yeah. He began his administration talking about the need for more money for roads, and we have only seen the tempo of calling for that increase as it hasn't gotten done.
So this
it was really halfway through the first term that it moved to the top of the priority list after some other things were dealt with. And that clip you played was actually just a few instances of these seven times in a row that the governor said, vote yes, here's why, vote yes, here's why. And it was because, with a statewide audience on the speech, plus, the subsequent attention, the news coverage and whatnot, that he couldn't pass that by. But it does speak to the challenge that is facing the governor, that the early polling is not good, that the success rate on these ballot questions to raise taxes, especially, the sales tax, which must be voted on because it requires an amendment to the state constitution. That the track record is not that good. And so he's going to have to go get in front of it in a big way to persuade people that this has got to get done.
There was a lot of hope in the lame duck session that they would find some kind of solution to funding roads without going to a ballot proposal, an amendment to the Constitution like this. Is this a failure of the governor's leadership, or can you blame this squarely and lay it at the feet of the legislature?
I don't know, what it might say about the governor's leadership that, he had to get the legislature to, go along, and you've got to persuade a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate to go along with you. This is certainly not what the governor wanted, though. First of all, the governor wanted this to be user fees, a fuel tax, registration fees, something, along those lines, which is also what the business community wanted. And if it did go to the ballot, then, Proposal A style, school funding from the mid-1990s, that he wanted there to be a backup plan, that if there was going to be a ballot question, then it was going to be an either or. And he didn't get either of those with this. That said, he's trying to make lemonade out of lemons and, get it done. If it passes, then it's, problem solved, at least for the moment. If it doesn't, then everything goes back to square one.
And we heard Gretchen Whitmer, the former leader of Democrats in the Senate, say exactly that at the press conference when they were introducing this. And a reporter asked her, what happens if this doesn't pass in May? And she said something like, I don't even want to have to think about, what that would look like. So, come the first week in May is going to be a really large vote on something that has taken up a really, really a lot of energy for this governor.
And the governor is still expending energy on, the early stages of this, going out and trying to build support among the business community for this. Because like I said, this is not what they signed on for. And so he's got to go and meet with boards. The Detroit Regional Chamber is already on board. He's got to make the same pitch to a lot of other business boards. And remember, campaigns, especially campaigns that ask taxpayers to do something difficult like raise taxes, are expensive. And the same business leaders that he's approaching to support the road funding ballot proposal are pretty much tapped out after the campaign last year for the personal property tax proposal.
Groups of people that he's always had a bromance with are suddenly like, whoa, not so sure we're going to support you on this one.
Are we going to see Americans for Prosperity or some of the other Tea Party groups putting out ads saying, vote no, we don't need higher taxes?
All of the above.
Yeah, okay. So that's what we've got to look forward to till May. We'll see what happens. happens then. I wanted to move on, and the governor talked about river of opportunity, and there were a lot of metaphors about getting with the stream, and I got to tell you, it all sounded kind of nice, but I kind of got lost in the mainstream of the stream and wasn't sure exactly what he was talking about.
You were drowning in metaphors, Lester?
Is that what you're saying?
Sorry, I had to do it.
Swimming upstream, were you?
Save me on this one. Somebody throw me a life preserver. What was he talking about?
Ouch.
Well, look, I mean, the governor is a CPA, not an English major, and clearly he was trying to work that one. And the point was, I think the point that he was trying to make is that society is moving, but some people are moving ahead faster than others, and that one of the goals of the second term is to try and bring everyone into the mainstream of that river of opportunity. That's the working metaphor.
Which is interesting to note. I mean, Lester, earlier in the show, you talked with, you know, a couple congressmen who, you know, were at the State of the Union speech. But there was this interesting parallel between the governor's speech and President Obama's
right,
speech last
middle
night.
Middle class economics, this, river of opportunity.
Uh-huh, exactly. And this sort of sudden look at, you know, we know the economy in terms of some statistics. Many statistics look from the outside like it's doing better. And yet there are groups within the middle class, the lower middle class, who are not feeling it. And we heard this from both the governor and the president last night about creating these new opportunities.
And what they want to deal with are the chronically unemployed and wage stagnation. And, you know, they both had, you know, their own approaches to doing this. You know, in the case of the governor, it was sort of the parallel paths of focusing on workforce development mm-hmm. and skilled trades, which he says is sort of, you know, part of Michigan's culture, you know, but also, you know, this merger of two major departments, the Department of Community Health and the Department of Human Services, into a Department of Health and Human Services. And the idea there is that you can streamline services, deal with things like, you know, different eligibility requirements for similar programs, and then get people on the path to independence.
I don't want to be too cynical here, but in the last decade, we've combined agencies and then separated agencies. And sometimes, from an outside observer, it kind of looks like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. So will we actually see, the governor stressed that we got to stop talking about programs and start talking about serving people, and it makes more sense to serve people with this kind of, I suppose, one-stop shopping for helping them, you know, get the help that they need and guidance to becoming productive workers. Is that the goal here?
Sure. And that's just it. The idea is that, you know, these are two departments with a lot of agencies within them that have similar functions. And your observation is spot on. You know, someone is always trying to solve something here in Lansing. And so you see two departments that have similar functions, and people look at that and go, well, why don't we combine them and, you know, have them work together and be more streamlined and efficient? And sometimes they'll look at a department and go, well, you know what, those agencies that they may be similar in function, but they have different core missions. So let's separate them out and let them focus on their core missions more effectively. I mean, that's what we saw with the Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Natural
Very
Resources.
Very early on the governor's first term. It is interesting to note that with that, though, I think there came from this Republican governor some conservative talk, which, you know, the speech was not incredibly full of conservative talk from the governor last night.
Oh, no, there was plenty there for,
Democrats.
The oasis was opened to Democrats, you know, Republicans.
Yes, but this merger, this idea of creating a more efficient government, that was something that did get quite an applause from Republicans, and that we are hearing a lot of support about from more conservative folks, this idea of, you know, creating smaller government.
But even Democrats are saying that they're on board with the concept. Uh-huh. They just want to see how it plays out. Is this really about getting better services to more people with a better result, or is this just about saving money?
And as I say, smaller government, we should also note, too, this would then create the state's largest department. Gong, where News was reporting that it would be 46% of the state's a little over $50 billion budget. So big numbers.
Not surprising, though. I mean, besides the Department of Corrections, I mean, these human services
Not surprising at all. Not surprising at all.
I want to go through several things really quickly. One of the things is, I remember I was in the chamber when the governor did his first State of the State speech, and he talked about P through 20, preschool through 20 years old. Last night he talked about preschool through third grade. Is this a shift overall, or is this just a concentration of here's where we need to get things done first?
Well, he spoke about both of those, Lester, that, you know, the third grade reading is a goal because there's a lot of research that shows that students who aren't competently reading by the third grade, that is, you know, that they have comprehension and instead of learning to read, you know, after that they're reading to learn, then they just fall behind. But the governor also spent a lot of time on the transition from high school into higher education, especially community colleges and those skilled trades, but also, you know, into a four-year education. He talked about middle colleges and, you know, where high schools and community colleges sort of, you know, are combined into one track, that you're actually earning credits while you're a senior in high school. No, that's still very much a part of the governor's thinking.
He also briefly mentioned having a dialogue about protection for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people within the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act. Afterwards, Representative John Hoadley of Kalamazoo had something to say about that.
There's a real reason he's putting it out there, because business leaders in Michigan, the governor recognized that we need this for talent retention. And this is about, I think, laying about a broader conversation in the state of Michigan.
Now, I did see some complaints on Facebook and other social media that possibly the governor could have been a little stronger in his language. He was kind of ambiguous. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Zoe?
All of those things, but those are not new arguments. I mean, Rick and I can both remember back in May at the Mackinac Policy Conference, there was this huge to-do because the governor came out and he said, hey, legislature, let's remember, completely controlled by Republicans. Hey, I want you to debate adding LGBT rights to the state's Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act. Rick and I had a sit down, just the two of us, with the governor about 20 minutes after. And we said, oh, so you're endorsing adding. And he said, no.
Mm. Well, so previously he had been silent about it.
Right.
Then he said that it's time that we talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the legislature is not simply a debating society, that you don't ask the legislature to talk about something without seeking a result, an action, a policy, you know, to come out at the end. And last night he actually did say, let's show people that we can resolve this.
So what I was going to say is that, yes, that he has gotten a little closer to something, not an endorsement, but he keeps putting his toe in a little bit. And this goes to a little bit about also, I think you can bring in some of the court cases that are happening right now.
And there's been a shift overall among the population. I mean, it's really clear that if you put your finger in the wind, you can see which way it's blowing. So I'm guessing the governor is saying this is almost inevitable. We don't want to be standing on the wrong side of history at the end of the day if the people are moving
well,
in this direction.
Well, there were a couple of things going on there. And one of them was that this was a bit of a throwdown on the Republican leadership, who've said that they're done with this issue of Elliott Larson. If it's going to get resolved, it's going to be done some other way. And Lester, but that's also exactly what it was, that the governor was obliquely saying, you might think that conversation is over, but it's not over because it's something that everyone is talking about and you really don't have a choice. And as you pointed out, that we've got the court cases, that we've got the Michigan marriage case that's going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. We've got a federal judge who just validated the marriages of the 300 couples that were wed during that window last March. And keep an eye on what the Snyder administration does with that decision, whether or not they decide to appeal it before the early February deadline, because they may not.
And again, Lester, this goes back to this idea of what we were talking a little earlier in this conversation about, that this was a governor who, you wonder, now that this is, you know, his first speech of his last term in office, if he doesn't feel a little less held down by some of the conservative principles and feels a little more willing to talk about some more moderate issues, as we were saying, almost quite a few things in that speech last night that Democrats were standing up for and applauding for that maybe some more of the conservative Republicans weren't.
That's Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. They are the co-host of It's Just Politics. You can hear every week here on Michigan Radio talking about what happened last night with the State of the State and Governor Snyder. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thanks, Lester.
Well, you bet.
And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on in the new year? What issues do you want to hear more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're also on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. And you can find us on the website, michiganradio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, and Lindsay Scullin. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.